Welcome, everyone. Smiles. What a beautiful morning it is here in Philadelphia, and we hope elsewhere also. We have volunteered to inform you about Philadelphia ULT, and its sole purpose is to spread broadcast the teachings of Theosophy as recorded in the writings of H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge. We advise that you pick one of these up if you haven't done so already. For the policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of Theosophy. Without professing attachment to any Theosophical organization, it is loyal to the great founders of the Theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or the inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principle of the philosophy of Theosophy, and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profound conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among Theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor opposites. The sole bond between its associates being that basis, and it aims to disseminate this idea among Theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards us Theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, or creed, or sex, or condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true Theosophy belongs to no cult or sect, and yet belongs to each and all. Carry out the purposes of this declaration, we meet twice a week. As you see, we opened promptly at 11 a.m. this morning, but the doors were open at 10:30 so that you could come in and have a seat. Same thing happens on Wednesday. The doors on Wednesday open about 5:15 so that you can come in and spend 2 hours in the library, which closes at 7:15. And 7:15 to 7:30. We begin promptly at 7:30 and it's over at 8:30. Now, incidentally, the library is where it's a reference library, and you'll always find a volunteer in there to help you become acquainted with all the literature that we have on hand, Theosophical literature as well as many other books. Today is June the 2nd. And the topic is Theosophy in Daily Life. On Wednesday, we have a study class in the Ocean of Theosophy. Wonderful little book by William Q. Judge. It is our purpose every Sunday to give a reading before the lecture begins. And this Sunday, the reading is from this wonderful little Bhagavad Gita. It's in the library, and you can ask about this wonderful little book afterwards. To wit, a man is said to be confirmed in spiritual knowledge when he forsaketh every desire which entereth into his heart, and of himself is happy and content in the self, through the self. His mind is undisturbed in adversity, is happy and contented in prosperity, and he's a stranger to anxiety, fear, and anger. Such a man is called a muni, a wise man. When in every condition he receives each of it, whether favorable or unfavorable, with an equal mind which neither likes nor dislikes, his wisdom is established. And having met good or evil, neither rejoices at the one nor is cast down by the other. He's confirmed in spiritual knowledge when, like the tortoise, he can draw in all his senses and restrain them from their wanted purposes. The hungry man loses sight of every other object but the gratification of his appetite. When he has become acquainted with the Supreme, he loses all taste for objects of whatever kind. The tumultuous senses and organs hurry away by force the heart even of the wise man who striveth after perfection. Let a man, restraining all these, remain in devotion, at rest in me, his true self. For he who hath his senses and organs in control possesses spiritual knowledge. He who attendeth to the inclination of the senses in them hath a concern. From this concern is created passion, from passion anger. From anger is produced delusion, from delusion a loss of the memory, from the loss of the memory loss of discrimination, and from loss of discrimination loss of all. But he who free from attachment or repulsion for objects experiences them through the senses and organs, with his heart obedient to his will. He attains to tranquility of thought, and this tranquil state attained therefrom shall even result a separation from all troubles. And his mind, being thus at ease, fixed upon one object, it embraceth wisdom from all sides. The man whose heart and mind are not at rest is without wisdom or the power of contemplation, who doth not practice reflection, hath no calm. How can a man without calm obtain happiness? The uncontrolled heart, following the dictates of the moving passions, reach snatches away his spiritual knowledge, as the storm, the bark upon the raging ocean. Therefore, great arm one, he is possessed of spiritual knowledge, whose senses are withheld from objects of sense. What is night to those who are unenlightened is as day to his gaze. What seems as day is known to him as night. The night of ignorance. Such is the self-governed sage.
Thank you. So you've heard the wisdom of the ending of chapter 2 in the Bhagavad Gita, or Bhagavad Gita, we should say. And we really can't do any better than that. When it comes to a guide for practicing theosophy in a daily, usual, you know, an everyday matter, it talks about withdrawing like the tortoise, those wanted senses, those usual, customary, unthinking reactions. So we're advised to question and to look at our reactions, to watch our words and our deeds, to really sharpen our vision, because vision is a universal quality, but are we using it just to, in a limited way, or are we fully looking and observing like an art student is taught to really look and examine every little detail, every fine line. So we're all born with vision, and we're actually born with inverted vision. It takes the baby, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks for that inverted vision to upright itself and to start to see things as they appear. But really, in a sense, everything is upside down in this life because of the age we live in and the astral atmosphere inverts and reflects illusions. So we need to see things physically and metaphysically as they really are. And the wisdom of the sages through the ages, they have given us a wealth of information. Much of it runs counter to what we've been enculturated with in today's world. It's a very materialistic, very competitive world. But when one is drawn to theosophy, one is already knows the fact that things are, there's something wrong. There's just something not quite right. And so there are those, but it seems like everything goes their way. And we may say, what great karma they have. They have, you know, they've got the house, they've got the car, they've got the relationship, they've got 4 houses. It's all very superficial, and it's not intrinsically satisfying. It's really empty. We see it's the void of the seeming full. But theosophy goes for the fullness of the seeming void. We're looking beyond matter, we're looking beyond illusions, beyond the veil as much as we can. We're trying to lift that veil off of the shiny objects that are always trying to get our attention. So theosophy in daily life is the quest. It's the quest for and its application of spiritual knowledge. Now, when we don't have spiritual knowledge, a man whose heart is without rest, if there is no reflection, there is no calm. If there is no calm, there is no happiness. So if we're constantly chasing after this, that, or the other, we're never at rest. And if we're never at rest, of course, there's not calm, and there's not true happiness. There's just one ephemeral event or vision or circumstance. So we're told not to overload the senses. I mean, in this world, there's a lot of sensory overload. And although we won't be going into meditation and contemplation because that's next week's topic, we just will mention briefly that we should find a time every day for meditation and contemplation. And whether it be in the evening or first arising or both, it can be done. And before we go to bed, we should review the day in as many details as we possibly can and look over, you know, what we done, what we did, what we think we did right, how perhaps we could have done better. And if we make a daily practice of this, we will be calmer. So theosophy is a body of knowledge which embraces the entire universe, hence every aspect of ourselves. Theosophy gives us food for thought to the greatest minds, but will not overwhelm the understanding of a child. So these ideas are attractive to children because they're inclusive, they're whole, they're not separative. We all have this deep need to feel like we belong, that we feel like we want to be a part of something, some greater whole, some greater purpose, that life does have meaning. And children understand this instinctively. So these great teachers, adepts, and sages, they've made it practical. And we want to say, too, we do have some daily books of quotes by three teachers of theosophy, the two main teachers and the student who began the United Lodge of Theosophists. So every day, these are seed thoughts. We can look at these daily books, and it just so happens that today's quote is by Robert Crosby, and the quote is, "There is no need to grope, nor stagger, nor stray, for the chart that has led so many to the goal is in your hands, in the philosophy of theosophy." So theosophy has to be lived, it has to be practiced, and it has to be applied. It's very practical. It's a practical science. It's a religious science. It's philosophical science. And the word science means to know. And so it's the perfect blending of religion, science, and philosophy. There was, when Descartes basically made a deal with the church hierarchy, that we will handle the soul, that the hierarchy will be in charge of the soul and spiritual knowledge, and you can have the scientific physical knowledge. Although it was seemingly the beginning of the Age of Enlightenment, it was actually a huge setback for the synthesis of science, religion, and philosophy. The efforts were started by the masters of wisdom about the time of the Renaissance, but it was these efforts were periodically brought forth in the last quarter of each century until the last quarter of the 19th century. These writings became public, and they were put forth here first in the United States of America because of the efforts over a couple of hundred years of seeding the soil with the religious toleration, which was really kicked off by William Penn. The republic that we know as the United States, with freedom of thought, freedom of speech, assembly. And in the 19th century, we have the modern theosophical movement is brought forth before the world. And although it was started in the US, it soon moved to India and England, and really all around the world. And other movements in the past had been for a limited amount of people, but The Theosophical Movement, as we know it today, is a worldwide movement. But it has to be lived, it has to be practiced, and it has to be applied. Much of it is very poetic, such as the Bhagavad Gita, the Voice of the Silence, Light on the Path, are all great devotional books that are very elevating, but we have to live, practice, and apply it to every situation. It needs to become ingrained rather than just grafted. Theosophy teaches us that we're not, that there is no such thing as vicarious atonement, that there is no outside God, that the deific principle cannot be defined. It can really, in a sense, it can only be defined in what it's not. You know, it's not a being. It's not a person. It doesn't have attributes. We can't apply attributes to it. It is beyond all that. It is omnipresent. It is immutable. It is boundless. It is all-knowing. And periodically, we are brought forth during periods of evolution that all is for the benefit of the soul. All knowledge all true knowledge is really soul knowledge. So there is no absolution, no vicarious atonement. We need to do the work. We can only be redeemed and balanced by our acts. And our acts, action, karma is action. So our past acts come before us, and then we need to act. So we need to think elevating thoughts and adopt a cheerful attitude, and we need to set kindly acts into motion. And by doing this, we radiate this knowledge. We people are current in space, as it were, because we're these dynamic electromagnetic beings who were always broadcasting, like a radio or a television program or the internet for that matter, that there's one whole and we're all connected. So our actions affect the entire world. And we, in a sense, are affected by the entire world as well. So that's why meditation and concentration are so important, because we need to withdraw and we need to regroup from time, you know, daily. So compassion is no attribute, it is the law of laws. It is our great desire should be for universal happiness and love. So there's something called kama, or it's desire, K-A-M-A. It's a Sanskrit word. And we often talk about the lower passions and desires, but we're told how to transmute these desires, because kama is preeminently the divine desire of creating happiness and love. The expression desire first arose in it, which is the impulse for evolution. There, in a sense, it's an unfolding from within, not a big bang where everything just happens as once. But it's a progressive unfolding. It takes eons and eons to make the forms that we now use, which are instruments for accumulating experience and knowledge and transmuting, in a sense, the dross into the gold. So when we first start to work for others' sakes, the master or guru takes notice. So one of the theosophical, there are no musts in theosophy. There's no dogma. You must not believe anything. But one of the concepts that is prevalent is that we are perfectible. We're not poor, miserable sinners, but we're perfectible. That we are, in essence, gods in the making, nascent gods. So we posit that there are these masters and gurus, these souls who have perfected themselves in prior periods of evolution, who keep this knowledge, who keep theosophy alive and before the public. Sometimes actually before the public, and sometimes the knowledge is withdrawn because it can become dangerous. It can actually threaten certain vested interests. And so these spiritual ideas are sometimes considered subversive in a way, but they are subversive because they're trying to subvert the dominant paradigm of materialistic, the be-all and end-all of materialism, which of course is empty. So when we first start to work for others, these masters, they're working behind the scene because they've already perfected themselves, but they need us to do the work. So they take notice. The holy ones cannot work for us, but can provide gentle breezes of soul wisdom, encouragement, hope, and energy to do the work that is sorely needed today. So again, they're not outside gods. We possess that master within us, whether it be an embryo or if we are well along the path. But we are warned not to be concerned with our own progress, for that is personal and will stop growth. Whenever we're looking for praise or reward, that all has to do with the personal man. And the mission of theosophy is to spread, broadcast his teachings to the whole world and to realize that we are not our bodies, we're not our minds, we're not our thoughts, we're not our feelings, that we are spirit and evolution. And we are trying to, the message of theosophy is that we are perfectible and we are on this path, and that there's no one that's to be left out or to cast aside or looked down upon, because we have no idea what that soul is experiencing or how advanced that soul can be. A person may seem to be in dire straits, but we should not judge. We should not say, well, they deserve that. Even if they do, that is their karma. They're transmuting that. But our job is to help, never to hurt or hinder. So if we look at our personal growth, we're not growing. So we're trying to lend a hand and to help create. If everyone would help put out their hand, there'd be more helpers than there were sufferers in this world. So we need to get beyond the separateness, the illusion of separateness. Because as the Buddha said, that's really the greatest sin. It's the illusion of separateness. We're all one, we're all on the same path. So theosophy demands and expects mutual understanding and charity for each other's shortcomings. So the concept of freedom in theosophy, it's a freedom of thought, conscious expression, and of action. We have been enslaved by ideas, and the soul knowledge is here to counter these ideas, to spread the universal truths, to raise up the veil of gross materialism, which is the bane of our life's current existence. So we must keep before us freedom. It is never a gift, but is the pearl of great price. So freedom isn't given, it's earned. It must be constantly earned. It's nothing that should be taken for granted in any sphere of life. So to endeavor to understand and love our fellow man, we need to look at the whole being, warts and all, you know, and we should not scoff. We should not scoff at anyone. If we're spurned, that's okay. If we're derided, we need to realize that, you know, we're really all one. There's that in me as well. We're not completely separate. So just because one calls oneself a theosophist does not make oneself so. We can know all the principles, we can know the paramitas, we can know the Bhagavad Gita inside out, we can quote chapter and verse, but it's how we live it. It's how we live it that counts. And there's an expression, he does good who knows how to do good. So the heart and mind need to work in sync in order to be an effective altruist. So theosophy is true altruism, but altruism, it takes knowledge, because often well-intended acts without knowledge can cause chaos and disaster. So not that we should still try, but all along we need to gain in knowledge and wisdom, and we only get that by making mistakes. So certainly anything well-intended is good, because it's the intent that really counts. So theosophy doesn't believe in prayer or propitiating any outside being or God or praying to the saints or whatnot. We believe in taking our karma as it comes to us. But the most perfect prayer is the Lord's Prayer, which is actually a command. It's actually not a prayer when you think about it. It's a command. It's a command to our higher self, which is our Father in heaven. It covers our true spiritual identity. It covers karma, forgiveness, and protection. So we do not pray for a specific good to happen or to avoid specific evils for ourselves or others. So we need to develop this internal compass, and that's what the philosophy does. It's a compass that we take with us that guides us through life, so we can navigate through all the distortions that we come across daily. So in closing, if we daily meditate, contemplate, and demonstrate the principles of theosophy we have been entrusted with, then these seeds we've been entrusted with, we can start sowing the field which needs sowing. It's sorely needed. The theosophical principles are, and they're everywhere. We certainly don't have a monopoly on it by any means. But we are here to spread broadcast the teachings as best we can, to the best of our ability, on a voluntary basis. There's no experts or authorities here. You are the authority. You are the only authority. So at this time, your questions and comments are welcome.
Well, we noticed the topic today, theosophy in daily life. Yet this little book called Bhagavad Gita, and then Krishna speaks, and it's all in those first few paragraphs. But it was Krishna. What do you mean by Bhagavad Gita and so forth? Well, we mentioned Wednesday night, there are 2 hours in the library, always a volunteer there, so that one word doesn't go in there and out the other, and it can be expected to understand the problem. So keep in mind, the library's there, so we can embark on a new adventure whereby we are helped to steer our boat in the right direction. So when we hear this terminology, we don't get cast down. And it says Krishna, and man is said to be confirmed in spiritual knowledge. We take that first paragraph does the most.
A man who is confirmed in spiritual knowledge. Well, how is one confirmed in spiritual knowledge, we might ask?
Well, it continues to tell you.
Okay.
And it says, he forsaketh every desire.
Ah.
Which entereth into his heart.
So how do we forsake every desire that enters into our heart? That's a tall order, isn't it?
Well, as it seems so. But here we learn who we truly are. Not what we see in the mirror. And we learn how to conduct ourselves in a reasonable fashion. So, the combination of the library, of meetings, and so forth, is to help point out the way. And we begin to apply these ideas in our daily life.
So we have these instructions for living, and we make no profit here. We don't pass a basket, only voluntary contributions. However little is fine, or nothing is fine. There's no coercion whatsoever. Everything is voluntary. So we need to, we have this great library here. All of our books are strictly at cost, no profit to be made. Mostly everything online now as well, so we don't need to buy the books that we have. It's our birthright. This is our heritage. These are the instructions we were given long ago, but through misuse and disuse, many of us have forgotten. Yes, go ahead.
It seems a comparative study of religion impresses us with the idea that it all boils down practically to loving thoughts, loving words, and loving deeds. And there are different motivations and goals in those religions. What does theosophy tell us about the dynamic effect, the influence of our love, whether it's in thoughts, words, or feelings, has on the world around us, the kingdoms below us, the mineral, vegetable, animal kingdom, other kingdoms? What effect does it have? Is it something that just lives and dies within our own nature? How does it affect others?
Well, theosophy says that we're human dynamos. We're generating, we're projecting, we're dynamic, we're electrodynamic and explosive. We have greater powers within us. We have all the powers of the universe within us, and that includes explosive. We've all seen people explode in anger, and so usually that's been simmering for a long time. But we affect all of those around us. So if we think loving thoughts, if we do loving deeds, if we have these thoughts, words, feelings, actions, it's picked up not only by those closest to us, but everywhere. It's a transmutation. It's a cleaning up of that astral atmosphere, which is highly polluted. But that's what we're dealing with. That's the lowest atmosphere. That there are higher planes of being beyond that. But that's the plane that we live and breathe and have our being in.
Take the responsibility on ourselves to study and to help others. And we think what was just said about compassion certainly fits in with the expectation of daily practice of compassion towards others. And it's almost like that's about the only dogma. Anything close to dogma, I hate that word.
So do we.
But is, you know, compassion towards others and trying to live towards universal brotherhood.
Yes, universal compassion, love. Doing what we can do. Sometimes the best we can do is to have good thoughts. Because other people are not receptive to words. So we have good thoughts. We have good, kind, loving thoughts. Those that have hurt us, those that have separated themselves from us for, often we don't even know why, but they're gone. And then we shouldn't spend much time in worrying about it. Although often we do, but we need to get beyond that and not think about the personal, because if we're concerned about perceived slights, then we can it's just endless. It can go on forever. And we need to bring ourselves back to the here and now and the teachings, and to just have good, kind, loving thoughts for people.
An idea just brought up was the effect of worry. You think that many people around us are prisoners of their own doubts and
sure,
worries.
Sure, sure.
And it's a big problem. And it's a big problem in our homes, our relationships, our workplace. It affects everything we do practically in life. So are there just a few, one or two practical ideas we could take from the philosophy and help us overcoming doubt, what we can have faith in to come overcome doubt?
Well, we can have faith that others have come before us and have risen above the illusions. And we have many examples, even within the past century, as Gandhi and Martin Luther King and others, that have shown us a way that, and it's not that they didn't have fear or doubts ever, but they managed to rise above them, to work through them. That intellectually you can have these feelings, but the feelings themselves can't hurt you. So we have to realize that we are, you know, we are eternal beings. We're right here, right now, in this century, time, age, city, atmosphere. But it's, we're ever present. We never were not. And we survived all the other times. We got through them, because we wouldn't be here if we hadn't. So why can't we, why shouldn't we have the confidence that we can survive whatever it is that comes to pass? Because spirit is eternal. We will survive. But the problem is, if we have fear and doubt, we might not learn the lesson. So we're here to learn. We're here to learn. Life is all about learning. If we continue to fear and doubt, we may lose the lesson. But if we can put it aside, we can learn the lesson, and then the necessity will disappear. So we'll be able to dispel the fear and doubt. Yes?
Well, even if I don't learn this lesson, the church says that if I'm an eternal being, I'm going to do, what do I have to worry about? Why do I have to try to do good? Why, you know, they say that everyone would become like hedonists. You would have a world much worse than we have now if we didn't have some kind of outside restrictions.
That is what the church says, and that's for their own preservation. Because you need them. You need the priests. They're telling you that because it's job security. It really is. It's a job for them. And many of them realize, unfortunately, at least some of them definitely realize what they're doing. If they say you need an outside God, you need forgiveness, all you need is to believe and have faith, all will be forgiven. It's a drug in a way. It's a drug. So we need to look beyond that. We don't need the priests in this world. We don't need them. We can be our own priest, our own altar. Yes.
We're making the attempt to be devoted to theosophy and daily life. And we're mind beings. We live in our minds. We're soul monastic beings. What would that daily life look like? Would it be drastically different from the average person's?
Well, it would be, because we'd be free of fear and worry. We wouldn't be regretting the past or dreading the future. We'd be eternally present and in the now, and therefore an open channel for whatever comes our way. We'd be able to see clearly, in a sense. We'd really be able to see clearly. The scales would come off of our eyes. In the back.
And since we would be taking responsibility for ourselves, rather than an outside God or a priest telling us what to do, we would be an inward expression of what the soul is prompting us to do. And the Bhagavad Gita talks about doing your duty without any expectation of return. So if we have any doubt as to whether something is right or wrong, realizing that we are spiritual beings, that karma, it is our responsibility how to react to it. So we think that how our lives would look differently is that we would be taking responsibility. We wouldn't be playing the blame game. We wouldn't be saying, well, that's not my fault. So-and-so made me do it, or it was their fault.
Right. So in organized religion, they're either praising God or blaming the devil. And we have the God and the devil within us, both. We all do. We all have that capacity to do good or evil. That's what makes us, in a sense, above the gods. Because it says the gods were jealous because we have true free will. The ignorant are acting blindly. And those souls that are beyond our stage in evolution, these entities are like the archangels and the Dhyan Chohans, and they are one with the law. So they can't act against their own nature because they're one with the law. So we have free will and choice. We have this tremendous freedom. But the reason we have the freedom is because we haven't learned the lessons yet. Once we learn all the lessons, we become one with the law. But evolution is endless. It goes, when we talk about perfectibility and that we are perfectible beings, it's up to a point. It's perfection up to the stage that we're in now. But there's, in the back.
Well, given that we make the attempt to be a mind being, to think from universals, to be mindful moment by moment, as we would plan a daily life, what might be the outer manifestations? What might be the hallmarks or traits of a daily theosophical life?
We think a Buddha or a Jesus, we would just look at their example. The hallmarks, their loving kindness, their compassion, their being absolutely, not displaying anger or vindictiveness or anything like that. Just a really equipoise, we would say, absolute equipoise.
Well, we would think that it would be a certain amount of calmness that they would exude,
yes.
They would exhibit, even that those around them would feel that kind. It's probably manifest as a self-confidence.
Yes, a presence. There's a presence. And we've all been in the company of people that have, they just have a certain presence about them. And they're just, people want to be around them. And they know that they're safe in a way. They know they're safe and secure. Yes.
It seems that when people try to make these ideas practical, or even going to counselors or therapists, they're looking to solve the problem, escape the problem.
Right.
So when we get back to this question, how does life look different? How is everyday life different for somebody who thinks of themselves as a spiritual being? That person still has the same problems. They still face difficulties in the family, the workplace, maybe even more so if we take the Bhagavad Gita being true, the difficulties would be worse. But they still need calmness. They still need peace of mind, a silence to fight through those difficulties, to make a difference. That's why the Bhagavad Gita begins the way it does.
Yes, and in today's reading from the Bhagavad Gita, talks about how we can withdraw, the tortoise can withdraw everything within the carapace. So we look at the carapace as a protective shell. And we do have protection. There's something called the guardian wall of all the past adepts and sages and saints. And by its blood, it's cemented. We have this, you know, we have a protective shell if we will, if we learn how to withdraw our senses, and we still need to go through all of life's experiences, but we go through them. We're not sidestepping them. We're not like a rabbit, you know, running out into the rabbit hole, into the burrow. Yes.
Well, we always think of the name and stories of great captains, and naval warfare, etc., etc. And the phrase "steady as she goes." Hold the line, steady as she goes. Well, if you're a captain, you're going to recognize the state of the sea, shells flying overhead. How can you ever make progress through a battle if you're going to be upset also? So, steady as she goes, hold the line, those are ideas. So when we read the Gita and these, we are expected to think about them. And as we stated, the library helps you find your way so that it doesn't go in one ear, and suddenly out of the same ear, the other ear, without it having any effect. Steady as she goes are terms that you're familiar with from your youth. Therefore, the continuation found in these little books have a lot to tell you, but you have to think of them.
Yes, and we need constant reminders, and we need encouragement. We need reminders and encouragement to stay on the path and realize that the goal is attainable. Again, we're not concerning our own progress. We're thinking about the progress of the whole, of everyone, of the all of humanity, and the kingdoms below as well, where who will one day step into the man stage, because everything either was, is, or will be in the stage we are in now. That's evolution. It's progressive. It doesn't work in jumps and starts. Yes.
We can be assured that every spiritual idea that we have, or we hear, has an effect. We may not see it immediately,
right.
But, you know, hearing the word reincarnation and karma, we hear for the first time, it resonates within some it's just a word, but it's there, and it may reawaken again in some future time.
Thank you. Well, we need to close now. We just want to say we need to leave the results to the law, and so this week was Theosophy in Daily Life. For the month, the overall topic is practical theosophy. And next Sunday, June 9th, is the culture of concentration and meditation. Our meeting is adjourned.